Welcome back to Candid, where we have real talks with real people. I'm Shanae, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Bethany, Anise, and Dudley. And today we have a special guest, Devontae, who's going to be joining on the conversation today. So this episode, we'll be talking about the elections. You know, it's a new day in the Bahamas. The PLB administration obviously won the election, and that is going to be something that we're discussing today. So I was quite surprised when I saw how many seats of the POP won. Were any of you guys surprised by that?
Nah, I thought the POP was gonna like the same way the FNM won in 2017. I thought we was gonna have the same thing for the POP. So when they only got 32, I was like, so close.
Honestly, I was trying to do homework while it was happening. So I was like half paying attention to like Daryl Miller and Rodney being hilarious. And I just remember it was looking like more 50-50. And then out of nowhere, they were like, Minis concedes and the PLP win. And I was like, wow, that is crazy. That's not what I expected. But I didn't really have an expectation. I was quite wishy-washy on it.
Well, unlike you guys, I know I was asked several times who I thought would win. And honestly, I could not come up with, I couldn't decide. And even when the ballots were coming in, I still was like on the fence of who would win. And so, you know, that night was very, very, it was busy. It was very busy, especially if you were watching Eyewitness News on ILTV. It was like so much going on. But what about you, Devontae?
Well, for me, I thought it was going to be much closer than it turned out to be. I was actually one of the people. I'm actually one of those people that wants a well-balanced house. So I want that to be, I don't want it to be even, but obviously it can't be even, but I wanted it to be as close as possible. Even from my predictions, and predictions of some other people that I knew, all of us thought it would have been close to like 21, 14, something like that. But 32-7 was like, wow, you know, and I think it was crazy. And I think the former prime minister said when people turn out and vote, that is actually like a silent revolution. You know, when they vote in a new government so overwhelmingly.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I talked to Anise about this, and I was saying from a while that I thought the PLP was going to win, but I just thought that it would have been a little bit more on the fence. A good number of people didn't turn out to vote, because I think this is like one of the lowest in a while, right? I think it was 68%.
This is the lowest turnout in Bahamian history to the polls for election.
Well, yeah. First they were saying like 30-something percent, and then they had moved it to like 60-something percent, which I felt was a better number than 30. 30 would have just been like just such a bad look on the government and democracy on the whole.
Yeah, I think it was like 194,000 people that were registered, and out of that I think 126,000 people actually went out and voted. The reason why I think a lot of people said it was a low turnout was because voting at the polls was just so easy and so seamless and so fast. So it just felt as if like it was only a couple people there, when in actuality it was literally 100,000 people passing through the polls across the island.
Why do you think that happened? Why do you think it was such an easy process in comparison to like other elections?
Well, I think they learned from the advance poll. So at the advance poll, it was a mess. Some polling stations didn't open until 8:30. Some didn't open until 9. Some had to close late. Then you had the issue. I remember at the polling station where I worked, which was at UB, where all the Family Island constituencies were. There weren't enough election agents to inspect ballot boxes. There were also some issues with ballot boxes. After the advance poll, like things was just crazy. And I think the Parliamentary Registration Department really sat down and evaluated what happened on that day. And they used all of that to actually put on one of the best, what I would say, one of the best elections in the Bahamas, what I've been hearing as well. Like a lot of people commended them for how smooth the process was. The lines were moving very, very quickly. I remember early that morning, like the lines was literally robbed from in the school way back to the end of the street. And once they were allowed inside and everybody went to their various polling stations, it was literally a 5 minute wait, a 2 minute wait. I just was saying that I have to commend them for the process.
It was better than I expected, especially given that a lot of people were scared because of the fact that quarantine voters were allowed to vote. But you were saying that you worked at the polling stations, but you also work at Eyewitness News as an intern. So what was your experience during an election working as an intern in such a busy time?
It was very exciting, right? The night before, I didn't sleep at all. Like I was, you know, when you going away the next morning, you just don't sleep. That was me that morning, because I think we had to be to work at 6 a.m. to head out for about like 7:30. So when I arrived there, of course, bright eye, bushy tail, did no sleep. I was just going, went to the polls, did some interviews, just getting people reaction to voting, interviewing some of the candidates and everything. And I think I like just feeling the excitement of election day was what kept me going. But as things started to come down to a lull after I had already went back to the studio, which would have been like after 1 o'clock, wrote my story, had it edited and everything that happened. And up until 3, I kind of crashed. But then I knew the real work had to begin, because after that was the live broadcast, which is what everybody is watching, right? That's where everybody that works in the media, that's where they truly shine. So like I said, it was exciting. It was nerve-wracking. I'd do it all over again, though, in a heart.
Well, I'm glad that you enjoyed your experience. Going back to the advance, when you guys were talking about the polls, I remember driving on the advance polls, and I kid you not, I was driving past, I was marathon, and I was stuck in traffic for 10 minutes, and I moved 5 feet. And it was just ridiculous. The people were all over the roads. And honestly, I was just really afraid, because I was just like, is this what it's gonna be like on election day? And I went with my mom to vote, and it was really seamless. And I was just like, wow, this is not what I expected at all. So I just saw today that Dr. Hubert Minnis has said that he is resigning as leader of the party. According to the Nassau Guardian, this is a story written by Jasper Ward, she said that the Free National Movement leader, Dr. Hubert Minnis, will stay on as leader of the party until a new leader is selected at the FNM's convention in November. Chairman Carl Kumba announced last night, adding that Minnis has pledged to work with whoever succeeds him to ensure that the FNM is battle ready for the next general election. So how do you guys feel about that?
Okay, I'm gonna give you my conspiracy theory, but this is purely my opinion. But the way that this election was like announced, and the way that it was rushed, it seems, and the way that it was just so unthought of, I really think that he did not want to win. And that's just my opinion, but like there was no way that the FNM could have won the way he just went about the things. And I believe that he really just didn't want to be in office anymore. Like I think he was doing like a little bit of like reverse psychology when he was like, I'm gonna win, we're gonna win, we're all gonna win. I was like, no, I don't think so, but okay. What do you guys' thoughts?
I kind of agree with that theory. And I also kind of find it interesting that he's been labeled as the country's worst prime minister, and I don't even think he expected to win Kalani. Yeah, I don't think he expected to win his constituency is what I'm saying. Because how is you just jump ship? I find it kind of interesting that he decided to walk away.
I think what happened over the last 4 years has really been, I don't want to say damaging to the FNM, but I think what Dr. Minnis was trying to do is just take the FNM to another level. And of course, those people from the older times weren't ready to go, and they weren't ready to let go of that FNM, of the old FNM. So what he created was a divide in the party. And I think we saw it a lot on this campaign trail and even throughout the years. He created a divide, and now that he's lost, now that the FNM is lost, and everybody is saying that he was the reason that they lost so bad. And I'm talking like they lost 45,000 votes from 2017 compared to now. They had 45,000 less votes. So a lot of people are saying, you know, Dr. Minnis is the reason. So those, you're seeing like a lot of those older FNMs, and even some of the people that wanted to go to the new FNM, they're kind of going back and be like, hey, I don't want to go down this route. Let's end this. And so I think him still wanting to be sworn in as the opposition leader, knowing that within 2 months, he will not contest leadership at the convention, which they say will be in November. I think that's a bit crazy, you know? It'll be interesting to watch and see what will be their next move.
I agree, Bethany. Dudley, any thoughts?
Well, I think as a country, we went through a lot, but you know, through the past 4 years. And I think if you really were to put yourself in his shoes, like you would feel some type, you'd feel, you know, defeated in some ways at a lot of points. I know even before Dorian and the pandemic, a lot of people weren't really siding with the decisions he was making. But I think a lot of his supporters, like Devontae said, they were on the fence. The older FNM supporters, they were on the fence with the vision he had. And then of course you saw on the campaign where Hubert Ingram, you know, he was there supporting Dr. Dwayne Sands, and he would not comment on his endorsement for the prime minister. So I could kind of see where Devontae would get his theory from, because, you know, Hubert Ingram, he would be that model for the older FNM supporters. So to see him take that stance against Hubert Minnis, that I would lean more on Devontae's view on what happened. But it was a lot, though. I think if I was Dr. Hubert Minnis, I'd say peace out to the country as well. Like, that was a lot. I don't agree with most of the stuff he did, but he went through a lot.
There was also apparently there was a phenomenon of a lot of people deciding against voting because they're like diehard FNM. So they're like, if I don't want to vote for the FNM, I'm not going to vote for anyone else. And that in itself just shows a lot about people's mistrust of what was going on. And a lot of people are complaining not of the way he ran the country. And a lot of people were also saying like they would feel bad for him because of all the things he's went through. But it was this idea that he just didn't handle it well in the way he presented himself, in the way that he spoke, in the way that he ignored certain things, like the closing of that road that led to the death of a lady, and just a lot of people still in limbo after Dorian. A lot of people are just emotionally affected by a lot of things that has happened. Not to say that it's his fault, but it may also be misconstrued the way that he would respond to things. And that's what people didn't like, I feel.
I think he needed a better PR, because if you were to even listen to the responses occurring under his address, his national address, you would kind of conclude that, hey, I need to speak to these people in a more appropriate manner. You know, you would kind of make progress on and kind of embrace what the people were asking of you. You know, don't speak to us like we're little children. Have more respect. Be more compassionate on this group of citizens. Even the time when he closed when we initially went into the pandemic and the curfew started and he just shut down the stores. And, you know, there were a lot of people, especially in the poorer areas, who didn't have the funds to, you know, pack up for the weekend, stuff like that. So it was like a lot of people feeling, you know, disfranchised and feeling like they were abandoned by the one person they had elected to care for them. And so I think the Bahamas was in a real emotional turmoil for the past 4 years, but especially during these last, I would say, two.
I don't really think the emotional turmoil was 4 years long. I agree with you that it's been the last 2 years, because ever since Dorian, and, you know, it's been a series of things that happened that would confuse the average viewer. And then you have those diehard supporters who was like, don't worry, trust in the plan. And then some of those supporters never received the support from the government. And even In the news article, it said, from the Tribune, it said that what really got Albaconians to vote the way they did was the response to Hurricane Dorian. Like, that's what caused them to vote the way that they did. And, you know, there's no FNMs that's elected for those constituencies. So it reflects on, it's what they always say about a leader, right? It's easy to lead when everything is good. It's when times of crisis that your leadership is tested. And it also has to do with, people don't really remember what you do at the start, but they are always going to remember what you do at the end. So all the little good things that Minnis would have done in the middle of his term got completely washed away because of Dorian and then everybody's own emotional reaction to the pandemic. So I feel as though everything within the last 2 years made it kind of clear that people weren't on his side as much anymore.
Yeah, I have to agree with you, Dudley, because if we're being honest, in the beginning of his term, Dr. Minnis has done some really good stuff for the country. You know, things check balance books, accounts were starting to be balanced. The deficit was decreasing and everything. And then we had Dorian. And then even when you look at the beginning of the pandemic, I think he handled it very well. But coming down to the end, I think the issue that occurred was that he just turned his back on the media. And the media is such a powerful tool that if you don't know how to use it to your advantage, you will fail and you will crumble and you'll be swallowed. And so him not answering their questions, members of his cabinet not answering the media's questions or sometimes being sarcastic, played a major factor in their favorability lessening, which ultimately turned out to them losing their seats and losing the government so terribly.
I would definitely have to agree with Devante. For example, Marvin Dames, when he was asked how quarantined voters would be able to vote, and he basically tried to connect it to people in jail not being able to vote, and it's almost the same thing. And I was like, that is not the same thing at all in any way. And I also don't like that they just allowed them to leave quarantine and go back, because it doesn't allow them to police them correctly. That could have been one of the reasons he was not voted back in, because of how that was such a, like, a lot of people didn't like that statement and it was so close to election. Why would you say something like that?
Right. Like the way they some of them handled the media was just ridiculous. When you look at people like Frankie Campbell pushing the mics out of the way, saying, there are 12 months of the year I spend
the first 6 months minding my business, the next 6 months out of everybody else's business, and I'm good.
Like, right. Sir,
why do your job requires you to mind people's business?
Exactly. Mind you, that was some good advice, but is that the forum to give it? No, you know. And like you said, you know, going back to the quarantine voters thing, that even I'm kind of cast a doubt over the FNM as well, because it showed that there was not a plan for those voters to go and vote. The Constitution says the only way a person can be hindered from voting is if they are incarcerated. And all people wanted was a plan for those people that are in quarantine, that may not be positive for COVID, that may have just been in the vicinity of somebody who had COVID, that is simply just quarantining out of the abundance of safety. People just wanted there to be a plan. And obviously it showed, his response showed, and the response of the health minister, and even I'd say the response of Dr. Minnis showed that there was no plan, and people was pretty much disappointed with that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I find it very interesting. The response of, I think it was Marvin Dames, like Anise said, with the quarantine voters, and it was another MP. I believe it was Desmond Bannister, if I'm not mistaken, who said, and I remember I watched Beyond the Headlines with Clint, and he was basically showing his frustration that these members of parliament who represent our country do not know the laws and are misinforming the people. And I thought that was so interesting, because I said, these are people that we choose to represent us and they don't even know the laws. And then the fact that they just sent them out there, I felt like, I don't know if they should have given them a separate polling station or maybe a separate part of each polling station to go to, because I don't think it was okay to just have quarantine people mixing with the regular population, it just doesn't make sense. And then all of those motorcades and rallies and stuff leading up to election, they did not think that this would lead to a spike in COVID. I remember I was driving on University Drive behind a truck, a motorcade truck, and nobody on the truck had on a mask, and everybody was just dancing and singing and having a good time, but nobody had on a mask. So it seemed that these COVID protocols went straight out the window once it was time to campaign. So for almost two years, everybody has been locked up following curfew. Businesses were getting fined for having too many people or for individuals not wearing their mask. I remember a man was fined for going to get water during one of the lockdowns. And a man, he was fined for selling coconut, trying to make an honest living. And yet these people are Bahamians, and these our representatives are basically partying on the back of trucks, and it's okay for them to do this in close proximity, no mask, no social distancing, and nothing happens, and it's okay. And this is on news, and this is in people are talking about it, and it's like nothing was done. I find that extremely disheartening, because it's just like the laws only apply when you guys want it to apply, and it's just annoying to me.
Speaking on the thing you said about curfew and the partying, we're going to see a spike because of that. And I felt that at some point, maybe a week or two or three later, that there would be news coming out, and I wanted to see who they would blame it on and what they would blame it on. And it was crazy that literally the next day after the Davis administration was sworn in, they had a newspaper article in the Tribune that said curfew relaxes, six more die. And I thought that was like, it was so fast. It was unbelievable. Cause how could you sit there and correlate those two things? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the deaths, obviously we can attribute that to the curfew being extended. You know, a lot of people say that the science doesn't prove that curfews stop the spread of the virus. You know, a friend told me, you know, even after the curfew hours, they're still on the road, they're still partying. And so there's still places and there's still room for COVID to spread, you know. And when we look at it, it's a lot of statistics show that people are catching COVID on the job. I don't know how many times you guys tried to go to the passport office and it was closed because somebody had COVID-19, right? So I think what that journalist did was, I think it's a bit of agenda setting, right? Because obviously we can't put those two things together. And that is where like ethics comes in as a journalist, you know? And so it was kind of disappointing, but you know, you can't beat people with a stick all the time.
Bethany, Dudley, any thoughts on that?
Just with the report about curfew being extended despite COVID deaths, right?
Yeah, so it was something similar to that.
All right, so it was pretty obvious, and like this was, when you try to believe in the ethics of journalism, it was honestly just a disgusting headline. But when you think about it, it's like the people who died would have more than likely have been suffering from COVID for a while. So how is it that you can say that decision to extend the curfew is a wrong decision when on the night of election, the curfew was extended for what reason exactly? Just because it was election that night? So I feel as though the decision to extend the curfew, it's like Devontae says, there are people who go against the curfew anyway, and they get around the island and they go and they party anyway. I mean, it's not like the curfew. I mean, numbers haven't gone up so drastically since with the curfew being 12 o'clock, but as we saw, the numbers still managed to get into triple digit new COVID cases despite the lockdown being at 9 o'clock. So, you know, it's very confusing about what exactly, how beneficial a curfew is, but blaming somebody or trying to correlate the death of people with the extension of a curfew is baffling, honestly.
I think we all agree that, you know, one didn't really correlate with the other. And like Devante said, it wasn't ethical at all. As journalists, we know that it's our duty to be ethical and unbiased.
All right. So we, over the past couple of days, we've had the swearing-in ceremonies. We've had the private swearing-in of the prime minister, then the public ceremony. And we had the deputy prime minister be sworn in, as well as for minister of tourism, investments, and aviation. And in the days of this week that have passed, we've had many, many appointments and long swearing-in ceremonies. So considering, I saw this tweet earlier today that was that, you know, the prime minister is supposed to appoint at minimum 8 cabinet ministers. Brave Davis, I think, if I'm remembering it right, I think he has the largest cabinet right now that has ever existed in the Bahamas. I think he has 22 cabinet appointees. Am I right, Devante?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's either 21 or 22.
Yeah, but he has the largest cabinet in for any prime minister. And there was a tweet that said, you know, it gets to a point where the House is supposed to be one branch of government and the cabinet is supposed to be another branch of government. What's the point of those two branches being separated if most of the people from one branch is going to be in another branch of government? Because with 22 appointees and 32 ministers, 22 cabinet appointees, only a few of them weren't successful in their bid for their constituency, and those guys became senators. How do you guys feel about that? That we just have the government going and picking the same people to do two jobs at once?
I'm not sure. I think we'll have to see how things pan out, because everything has an agenda. Every decision has a conclusion. So I'd like to see how things are going first. I believe there was one who did not get one because her husband is in the gaming industry. I think that was Leslie.
Yes, it's Leslie.
Yes. So I think we'll just have to see how things pan out. Do you guys' thoughts on that?
I agree with Elise. We have to, I mean, everybody's asking for a new change in the Bahamas. So I guess this is one way we're receiving that new day kind of change. I hope it isn't too much on, you know, the people partaking in these various roles. But I do believe that, you know, we should give it a chance to see whether or not we should stick to this change that Prime Minister Davis is enacting right now.
It's a very big cabinet. It's a huge cabinet. And I think, like we said, it was like about 22 cabinet ministers. And then there's another 6 parliamentary secretaries that were signed in today. So that leaves about like maybe 5 of those that were elected that have no position. And then when you look at it, out of that 5, you need to pick a speaker and deputy speaker. So I don't know exactly what was his train of thought. To me, it just looks like, oh, I'm just going to give you something. But I guess only time will tell exactly what is happening, what this is all about.
You get a ministry of state. So, but one of the things is that the prime minister in deciding who is a cabinet minister, he also basically sets their portfolio. And an interesting thing that I noticed, I don't know if any of you picked up on it, but we no longer just have oh Lord, what is it? The Minister of Medicine. Now you have the Ministry of Medicine and Wellness. And the wellness part. Oh, sorry. Sorry. We have the no longer do we have a Ministry of Health. We have the Ministry of Health and Wellness. And the wellness part is supposed to be focusing on is the Honorable Prime Minister saying that we're going to take a more serious look at mental health in the country. That's what the wellness part is for. And I think it's a timely decision that he made that call during suicide awareness month. So how do you guys feel about the idea that mental health is going to be taken more seriously in the country?
It's great. It was one of his campaign ideas to focus on that. And it's also why he was targeting a lot of younger voters as well, because that's something that we take very seriously. But we'll just have to see how that pans out and how he will do that. I hope it'll be the addition of mental health therapy therapists in NHI. I think that would be great because I need it.
I agree. I think it's a step in the right direction. It's being very progressive, you know. And I hope that this government follows through on that and it's not just changing the name or it's just creating, it's just trying to make it look pretty for, you know, their campaign, I guess. I was trying to say that they're delivering on their campaign, you know, this right after election. But he's trying to make positive change. I hope that a year and a half, 2 years in, that we're still here talking about changes that he continues to make that he said that he would live on. But I think that'll be great. Mental health is very important. We have a lot of issues in this country when it comes to mental health. And I hope that him doing that, and if he delivers on this, could help remove some of the stigma that a lot of people feel, because there are a lot of people here walking around this country who have a lot of baggage and do not know how to deal with it and are extremely dysfunctional because of it. And access to mental health care through NHI would be absolutely perfect. So I think that'd be great.
Yeah, I honestly have to just echo Shanae. You know, I think it's commendable that they actually thought about including mental health in the Ministry of Health and Wellness, you know, and the way the world is going now, that is definitely the step in the right direction. And even when we look at this pandemic and the people dealing with Hurricane Dorian, and like you guys said before, there was a lot of emotional turmoil. This decision to now involve mental health is just, it gets 10 straight across the board for me. And I, like Shanae said, I can only hope that in the next 2 years, in the next 5 years, when there's the next general election, we could say that something substantial was actually done in this ministry or under this portfolio. And I think Dr. Dowell definitely has a task in his hand, and the Prime Minister, to ensure that the work gets done.
Yes, well, I agree with all of you guys. It is a needful step for the country. We also have to look at ourselves. We can't only, yes, the government has a huge part to play in making sure that things are available. But when it comes to stigmatisms and stuff like that, we all have a part to play as a country to make sure that we keep each other accountable. But because, you know, sometimes there's a lot of conversation that occurs and a lot of people decide to, you know, to be quiet, to be silent, to not speak up on certain things that should be spoken on. I think with the government taking this step, a lot of people in the public as a whole, we need to move progressively in that direction as well and speak up on behalf of people who can't speak up for themselves. But, you know, 10 thumbs up for the Progressive Liberal Party for making this one of the changes that, you know, that they come into Parliament doing.
They definitely had a very strong start in changing the curfew and this mental health awareness thing. It's a great start. So hopefully they continue this and they continue this uphill battle that they're doing. Because like Devontae had said earlier, it's really what you do in the end that matters to a lot of Bahamians. But go ahead, Dudley.
Yeah, so since we're giving Brave all the credit, I mean, since we're giving the administration so much credit for what's going on, how do you guys feel about, because in speaking to the fact that it is now the Ministry of Health and Wellness, he said, and I'm quoting verbatim, he would have alluded to the fact that this onset of mental illness in the country is more so a direct result of Hurricane Dorian and the pandemic. And the way that it was said was in such a way that, oh, mental health has never really been a big problem before, but after Dorian and the pandemic, we got to take a serious look at it now. How do you guys feel about, you know, a statement like that?
I think it's very insensitive, because although it may not have been a topic that a lot of people discuss, it's a lot of things in this country are kind of like taboo. And so I feel like mental health is one of those topics. But for those people struggling with mental health issues, I mean, Sunderland's there for a reason. Sunderland's been there. So obviously it's been an issue for a lot of people. So for him to make a statement in that regard, it's kind of insensitive.
Yeah, I agree. It is insensitive. A lot of people in this country have been struggling with mental health. It may not be as severe as we may seem to go to silence, because silence is mainly for people who have severe illnesses or who need hospital around the clock care, and they don't have family or someone to help them or whatever. But it's not necessarily for somebody who may be suffering from depression, or they may not even know that they're suffering from depression, you know? And I feel like it should be more accessible. And I definitely think that Dorian and COVID has amplified some of that, because a lot of people have been talking about it, even on like social media, and expressing to people what they've been dealing with. But it's definitely been here. It's not something that just touched down in 2019 when Hurricane Dorian decimated Abaco and Grand Bahama. It's been here, but definitely those individuals who suffered through that definitely need therapy. So hopefully this program that they want to enlist will help everyone who needs it.
To be devil's advocate, I feel that maybe he should reword his statement, because it's so powerful. I feel that he was probably trying to say that the people, the direct victims of Hurricane Dorian in Abaco and Freeport, they have a lot of mental issues and trauma because of it. So what he should have said is that the Ministry of Health and Wellness, that they will be focusing on those victims, and then instead of trying to lower the stigma of mental health in this country, because that's been around for a while. And it's crazy, because me and Shanae were actually on a show on Guardian called The Eye Opener. And we were talking about the election, and somehow our topic completely changed from that to almost mental health and the stigma of rape culture and stuff in the Bahamas. And I feel that the Davis administration should definitely focus on social issues, because that is something that is impacting us a lot more than ever now, and making social issues legal issues like they should be.
I just think that, you know, what was said just really shows that why having a ministry would focus on mental health is so important, because I think there needs to be widespread education and destigmatization on mental health. And I think a lot of people just need to know how to speak to certain issues without being insensitive, you know? And that's why there needs to be like a national education program about mental health and getting people to understand that it's real and it's here, you know, and this is how you should treat it.
Well, the Prime Minister did not stop there. He's been, I don't know who's been advising him or helping him write the speeches, or if his Toastmaster training is coming back to him, But the man has been on, but the man has been hitting some pretty good points. For example, as he said, we currently face a desperate crisis in housing in our Bahamas. There's been a sharp rise in homelessness, which means that social services need to more actively and better support those who are affected. It is not good enough to offer people shelter for just a week, so we need to increase the stock of temporary and permanent housing. Thousands of people will struggle with rents and mortgages, and there's a lot more that's going on in that statement. So, but the Minister of Housing and Transport, the Honorable Jovette Colby, she said that one of the things that she is going to be reviewing is the
Prospect Ridge development.
They're going to be reviewing the Prospect Ridge development situation. So how do you guys feel about that?
That I don't think was the best thing to focus on as your first, as her first decision in her new position. I feel that if her ministry is housing, right? I feel that she should have focused on the Hurricane Dorian victims in Freeport and Abaco. I feel like that should have been the first thing she focused on instead of continuing something that was kind of put on the back burner during the FNM administration. I think it should have been left there. But
I feel as though housing is important, and a lot of people who came from Grand Bahama and Abaco have now relocated to relocated to New Providence. So I do think that she should be focusing on those victims, but maybe their intent, I'm hoping that their intention is to maybe take those individuals and try to create housing for them. I would assume so, because I would assume that they would be a part of that community of people who are displaced and who are homeless, or they may not necessarily be like homeless as in on the street homeless, but obviously they're out of their element. So I think that it's okay to start there, because why not finish something that was already started, instead of, especially in the financial state that we're in, instead of trying to create something completely new. So maybe that was their thought process behind that. That's how I would think about it.
For me, I have a lot of friends who, you know, have just recently got married. I have family who, you know, just looking for land on the whole. This is our country, and yet so many Bahamians can't even place their name on a certain property because it's so expensive. And to say that even it, most people, foreigners have more land in our own country than us. And so for her to focus on housing and providing, you know, the opportunity for families and single people to, you know, have the opportunity to afford such living, I think it would have been a good move for her. She isn't recently married, but she probably got married like 3 to 4 years ago. So she would understand that a lot of Bahamians are looking for homes and affordable land, and you know, the cost of living in the Bahamas is crazy expensive. So, you know, I think for her, that was a good move, because I want land too. So it is what it is. And plus, just because she said that she's focusing on Prospect Ridge doesn't mean that, you know, she is neglecting those islands that were impacted.
I'm not saying she's neglecting them. I just think it shouldn't have been the first agenda.
I mean, who says it's the first agenda? There's a lot of things that
it's the first thing that she spoke up about publicly.
Yes, but there's a lot of things that they're going into that, you know, they don't have, you know, real information on. So maybe she has more information on this project than what's going on in Abaco and Freeport, because that's a major project. You just can't come off the bat and say, okay, we're going to do this, and this, that. You have to actually look at what's going on and then make plans and then execute them. You just can't just say a bunch of stuff to the media and then not follow through with it. So I think she had already planned her execution for Prospect Ridge. So she thought it was a good idea to focus on that.
Devonta, you can go ahead and talk about your thoughts on the Prospect Ridge development.
So I think promising homes right out the gate, you know, after not even being a cabinet minister for a complete day, was kind of a tall order. I do feel as though continuing the Prospect Ridge development is a good idea. I think it was like 1,500 applicants that were successful. And from an optics standpoint, and also, you know, from a public relations standpoint as well, it'll look very good for the Progressive Liberal Party to continue that, to give those 1,500 people their homes, and those people that are already qualified. You know, obviously it's something that came under the Minister administration, but like we have seen with successive governments, things to start in one administration and finish in the next. So I think it's a good idea to complete it. Give them people the houses, man. They deserve it.
So working in media, what has been something you've realized in just your viewers, and how they have been reacting to both the FNM and the PLP administration and the changes in those?
So surprisingly, the people that so at Eyewitness News, we go live on Facebook, and a lot of times I just go log on to watch the comments. And surprisingly, the people in the comments have been taking it pretty well. You know, I guess, and then there are some people that criticize the new government. But I think what everybody wants is just for whoever is in, is that they actually do work and not just make a set of campaign promises on the campaign trail, or while they're in opposition, they rally the cause, but leave it in government. And I think that's something I'm looking forward to. I'm looking just for the new government to actually put into practice what they have been preaching over the last 4.5 years. And a lot of that's also what a lot of the commenters are saying. You know, although they are happy for Prime Minister Davis, they're happy for their favorites like Lenis Ana Martin and Fred Mitchell, they're happy for them to be back in government. They just want them to get the work done.
Speaking about Lenis Ana Martin and Fred Mitchell, what are you guys' thoughts on these ministers and what they've been elected to, like Lenis Ana Martin as education, because I believe she wanted aviation.
Yeah, so she was the cabinet minister. She was the minister of transport and aviation. I think the last time the PLP was in government, the last two times the PLP was in government, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm certain it was the last time. Seen her in education, I think is I'm comfortable and confident because I know what she is capable of, and I think she has the ability to take education to the next level with the advice of the experts that are within the ministry. So I'm pretty excited to see her under that portfolio. We obviously know Fred Mitchell has been foreign affairs for as long as we can remember. I'm sure he'll do well. I think one of the biggest shocks for me out of the cabinet ministers was the appointment of Ryan Pinder as the Attorney General. I did not see that coming. And knowing that his background is in finance, he's a finance lawyer, a tax lawyer. It'll be interesting to see what he does, especially with Jomo Campbell, who's a very strong criminal lawyer, as his Minister of State. So I'm pretty excited to see that duo in action. But that most definitely came as a shock to me.
Yeah, for me, not too well-versed as Devonta is with, you know, knowing the credentials of the ministers and what they were appointed. But all I could say is I hope they do their best, and I wish them nothing but the best, because if they succeed, then we succeed. And that's all I am hoping for. I mean, I'm really not a parties person, but whoever is there, I wish them nothing but the best.
I've been realizing this phenomenon of the Prime Minister also choosing to be Minister of Finance. Do you guys think that is a conflict?
Not necessarily, you know. Dudley, you can take it.
Yeah, I've always been confused by that, because we would see with I mean, let's think about it. We've had, we're now on our fifth prime minister. We usually see the prime minister start out as Minister of Finance or end up as Minister of Finance. And look at how many of them have that, have the level of qualification to understand it. I know a lot of people will say that in order to be a minister of an area, you don't necessarily have to be practicing in that area. But it's undeniable that if you're going to be the Minister of Finance, having a CPA, a CFA, some kind of degree that is in the field of finance is helpful. But we've had two lawyers that were the minister that acted in the role of Minister of Finance. They were also the Prime Minister. Dr. Hubert Minnis ended up being the Minister of Finance. It's like, why? What is it about that ministry that attracts the Prime Minister to it? You know, I think it's something that needs to be looked at more in depth.
Talking about the ministers, I think that Glenys Hannah Martin was a good choice for education. Jomo Campbell for legal affairs was a good choice. Obi Welshcombe for social services was an interesting move for sure, given his background in journalism and being a fighter. But we'll see how this goes. And I know that Jo Beth, Colby Davis, she had an interest in housing, speaking to her privately about it. But what are you guys' final thoughts on the election?
I'm glad it's done. I'm glad it's behind us now. The only thing I could say is let's just look ahead to the next 5 years and hope that things get better in the country and we see change in those areas that we need change in. And that's about it for me. I'm pretty excited to, now that we are entering the real world, I'm pretty excited to see what happens over the next 5 years.
Well, thank you, Devante, for being a guest on our show. I loved your opinions and I felt that you were very insightful in what you were saying.
Thanks for having me, guys. I had a lot of fun with you guys.
Thank you for tuning into Candid, where we have real talks with real people. Keep it real, Bahamas.